everybody. I'm Brian Kiley.
I'm Judah Sanders.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we're going to look at the social media trend of rejection therapy and see if there's anything to it. We'll look at the difference between stress and burnout, and we will give our take on the age-old question, can and should Christians celebrate Halloween? We'll play a little Blessed or Stressed. All of that and more on this episode of Engaging Culture. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Engaging Culture podcast. We were off last week, or at least we were not recording an episode, but we are back. Pastor Judah, we're back. How are you?
I am living the dream. Living the dream.
Living the dream.
It is good to be back. I missed a couple of weeks, and I'm glad to be back talking to you.
And here we are. So, best thing you saw this week?
Yeah. The best thing I saw, technically it was last week, but I spent 2 days in Atlanta. And one of the things that I did there was I went to the Trap Music Museum. Now, if you don't know what Trap Music is a subgenre of rap music that is birthed really out of the cocaine struggle in the South.
Whoa.
And so it's a very kind of particular style of rap music, and it's pretty intense because it's birthed out of, you know, those real experiences. Mm-hmm. And so what was interesting about this museum is that everything about it was meant to make you feel the experience of what it is to be very poor and black in the South. Mm. And so a part of it was this escape room where you were literally trying to escape a, we call it a crack house.
Whoa.
And the two women who were kind of the guides were so intent. They were like in character as these like two women who were selling cocaine.
Oh my gosh.
And trying to get out of this crack house. And so it was actually really clever the way that they used that setup to make this escape room, including like there was one clue and they were like, you have to find the keys to the refrigerator. And so we're looking all over. Where are the keys? Where are the keys? Where are the keys? It was keys of cocaine.
Holy
that,
moly.
Not real cocaine, of course, right. But like that was clever. And then you open the refrigerator and it turned into a trap door and you went to another room. And it was just, but what I was so impressed with, because I know this sounds all terrible, was.
No, what are you talking about? Can't wait to bring my kids there.
Don't do that. was how these women controlled the room, because it was a very intense escape room. Like they were yelling, where are the keys? Where are the keys? You know, there was like, yeah. The SWAT are coming. And you could tell that there were some folks, because we did this in a group with strangers too. You know, like you booked your reservations and other people did it too. And you could tell some of them were kind of triggered by it. And the way they just kind of controlled the room and controlled people's feelings. And when people were very kind of like, oh goodness, what's going on? Then they would, you know, bring us down. And it was just, it was a real interesting experience. But what I valued so much about it is being able to kind of step into the experiences that people have, right, in the world. And afterwards, my fraternity brothers and I, we left and we were thinking, man, like, we're stressed. We need to, like, bring ourselves down. Let's just go sit by the river. And just the idea that, no, like, this is people's lives, right? This is what, and nobody who's in that situation is in it because they really want to be, right? Yeah. Like, if they felt like that there was another pathway forward, they would use it. And so while it was not, the experience that birthed trap music is not a positive one, I think that there is something so valuable about learning how other people experience the world.
In that sense that, y'all were so emotionally affected by what is essentially a dramatization.
Right.
Which is a fancy way of saying fake.
Yeah.
Like, it's not real. It's a performance.
100%
And you're participating. And I think that element that you just said of going, okay, wow, that was really intense. We need to go relax. And for so many people in so many situations, like you said, that option does not exist.
That's right. They don't get to leave.
It's so, exactly. It's so easy for us to just immediately resort to judgment of people that are in these types of situations to go, but then to not go, well, what if I was born into that? I think that sense of empathy and just going, this is a truly tragic situation, which is not to condone whatever unhealthy or immoral choices are made. But just to go, like, it's not as simple as, like, well, I would never. It's like, well, you're maybe born into some situations.
I often say, anytime you're getting ready to judge somebody's decision, ask yourself, what were their choices?
Yeah, what were their options?
What did they have, you know? And the other interesting thing that I'll just say really quick is that kind of in each spot in the museum, because there were rooms that were like living rooms, there were kitchens, there were all of these spaces. And in each one, there was some sort of like religious symbolism, right? In the living room, there's like this picture of a black Jesus. In the jail cell that we got to walk through, there's this huge Bible that had been highlighted and scribbled on and all of this stuff. And so there was something really interesting about how even in the most painful spaces, most unhealthy spaces, most dark spaces, there's still this like hunger for God.
Yeah.
And this is why I'll just say this. I'm never worried about the church's relevance, right? Like sometimes people are like, oh, I'm worried about the church is not relevant. The church as a religious institution is going to ebb and flow in terms of how people view it.
Yeah.
But people have an inherent desire for their creator, whether they can name it or not.
Yeah.
And so I think that the darker a situation, the more opportunity there is for us to say, hey, we have a appropriate response to what you're going through. And his name is Jesus.
Yep.
So, amen. Yeah. Best thing you saw this week.
Yours are always so intense, and then mine are so simple.
next week, I'll just say I saw a really pretty butterfly.
Yeah. So, a lot of good stuff this week. But last Thursday was the home opener for my beloved Sacramento Kings, and my son Matthew and I got to go, and it was a great night. Like they didn't win; it was a close game.
Yikes.
But just great environment, great atmosphere. Players on the other team are really good. And I just, in my advanced age, I try to just remind myself, like, part of what I'm paying for is to see them as well. So I may as well try to enjoy it.
Did you have good seats?
And I mean, we had our regular seats that we sit in, and yeah, they're good.
Okay.
I love my seats because they are not very expensive, but they're still downstairs.
Right.
And
not up in the sky.
It just kind of works. So yeah,
sometimes
we've sat
at
in those,
the Golden River, Golden One Center, you'd be sitting up on a cloud.
Yeah, that's right. But no, we sit downstairs and it's not too expensive. And we've had those seats for a number years and sit there for, I don't know, a dozen or so games a year. But and it's just, you know, my oldest son and I really bond over sports, and especially, I mean, there's truly no one I would rather attend a basketball game with than him.
In
terms
of,
we have so much fun just talking about the game and then talking about other things in the breaks. And it was a great night. And I think, especially as just life gets busy and sports are just, you know, like they're fun. They're my preferred form of entertainment. But in the end of the day, they're entertainment. They don't matter. And there's part of me that goes like, okay, new season. Do I really want to do this? Do I really want to pay attention? Do I really want to spend the money and the time and everything else? And opening night was a good reminder to me of why I spend the time and the money, just because it's a great, great time with, in this case, my oldest son, but my younger son and I will go to some games. My wife and I will go to some games. I keep telling her she can bring one of the boys to a game if she wants to, but so far she is not taking me up on that.
She is my people.
That's right. So that's it. That was my best thing. We'll be right back.
Love that.
So, Pastor Judah, speaking for myself, I don't particularly enjoy rejection.
You're not a fan?
Not a fan. How about you? Do you enjoy?
I love it.
You do?
Love it. I just want to be told that you don't like me, don't want me, don't respect me.
You cannot have the thing.
It's so good for my self-esteem. Yeah. I just try to lean in.
See, there may be others who agree with the what you are saying sarcastically, or at least see some value in it, because while most of us try to avoid rejection
at all costs,
there is a recent TikTok trend of people actively seeking out opportunities to get rejected. And then they will film these encounters where they say, ask someone for $100 or make some kind of semi-outlandish request, go up to a barista and ask for free coffee. Mm. And they would film these encounters and then they upload them to social media for everyone
this
to see.
Smells like Gen Z.
Right. So, and they're calling it, I hate the term they, but those who are participating in this are referring to this as rejection therapy. And there are all sorts of articles online talking about different ways of seeking out rejection and kind of some of the benefits of that. So my first question for you on this is, Why is this a thing? Why is seeking out rejection trending?
I mean, I think it's because people want to grow in the ability to manage rejection. I think that that's ultimately what it comes down to. And it's kind of like a form of exposure therapy, right? And the idea behind exposure therapy is you expose yourself to like little bits of the thing that you're having a hard time with so that you become okay with it. And so as you were saying, people will, you know, say, hey, can I take a nap in like the mattress store on one of your beds? and, you know, what in the article, there is a woman who did a TEDx talk on this, and she, you know, decided to do this for 30 days straight. Every day she would ask whether it was for a hug or she asked if she could be a live mannequin in like in the store. And one of the things that she said that was really interesting to me was that she didn't get rejected as much as she thought. Like some of her outlandish rejections, yeah, people would say, sure.
Sure, you can have a hug.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Which I'm just trying to, if somebody just randomly asked me for a hug.
Really? You wouldn't do it?
I probably would, but I definitely think it would be like a thought. Like it would be like a, is this the killer?
Like I would think it's a little weird, but yeah, I would, unless there's something like obviously dangerous about the person, I think I'd be like, sure, I'll give
them. She also gives herself boundaries, right? Like yeah, she's not just like asking any old thing. She gives herself guidelines. She says she wouldn't ask for anything that she wouldn't be willing to do or give herself. But she said that it helped her to get to know herself and to have a better understanding of her emotions, like anxiety and stress in situations. And that by the end of the 30 days, that she just felt stronger in managing those kind of uncomfortable feelings. And so, look, I'm not entirely sure, like, why this is a thing, but I do think that I can see, like, how it could be valuable to just learn to be okay in uncomfortable situations. Because I think just in general, we just have no tolerance for discomfort, yeah, right? And you see that showing up in a myriad of ways.
Yeah.
I'm curious for you, do you think that this is healthy or helpful? And two, would you do it?
Okay, so number one, I feel like a broken record because so many topics I end up saying this. I'm anti the performative element of it. This idea
like
of, because even on some level, I almost feel like if I'm, let's say I'm recording an interaction with you and I'm going to ask you for something and the point is to get you to say no. Hey, Judah, can I have your car? Hey, Judah, can I, you know, like some really significant way of imposing on you. It almost feels a little bit like I'm kind of trying to clown you a little bit and trying to do that publicly. So I'm not into that. I'm not into performative anything. It's one thing to share our experiences on social media. Hey, I did a thing and I want to share about it or, you know, whatever. That's great. I don't have a problem with that. But when we go, the whole point of me doing this is so I can tell people about it. Like I am very anti that. And fair. I think that in a lot of ways, this sort of, this approach to quote unquote rejection therapy, that is very unhealthy because I feel like there's a self-aggrandizement element in it.
Look at me.
Now, exactly. Now, in the actual practice of it, I think with some cautions, I actually think there could be some benefit to this. So number one, it is not actually therapy. We need to be clear on that there are so many words that get thrown around kind of beyond their clinical definition. So, I mean, I'll refer to going for a hike or going for a run as trail therapy. And in a real sense, those things help me feel better. They clear my mind, whatever. But I'm also aware, like, that is not therapy. And one of the articles I was reading, somebody was, a therapist was saying, like, let's be clear. This is not an established therapeutic modality. With that in, with all of those things being said,
yeah,
I think we miss out on a lot if we fear rejection. And so often we limit ourselves in our ability to experience new things because we are so afraid what's going to happen.
That's
so
right.
One article in Fast Company said, fear of rejection often limits our choices, whether it's missing out on a date with someone special or hesitating to apply for a dream job. And that's where That's where I think for us to develop a little bit of resilience and a little bit of, like you said, an ability to tolerate discomfort would be helpful. And it's interesting. I look at my own life, and one of sort of the curiosities of who I am that I've never really quite understood is, like, I hate putting myself in situations where I could be rejected. Like, I love being with people. I hate organizing something. Because even the idea of, like, oh, someone can't come. Like,
100%.
It's so weird.
They hate me. Exactly. That's why they're not at church.
And it's like, I know that's not true. And yet I find myself, and what's interesting is adult diagnosis of ADHD, part of the thing that folks with ADHD deal with is called rejection-sensitive dysphoria, where you take rejection harshly to an unreasonable level. That's not a very compassionate way of describing it, sure. But that's essentially what it is. And so I even look at myself and I go, how often do I cut myself off from opportunities because I'm afraid to ask or I'm afraid to make the invitation? So that's where I think developing that resilience muscle is really helpful.
Yeah, one of the ways that I do practice this in kind of an unofficial way, and I teach this to my students a lot, is I always tell them, A, ask for what you want. Let them tell you no. Don't you tell you no, right? Because what will happen is somebody will say, well, I really need this thing, but I don't want to say anything because they're probably going to say no. And it's like, well, they might, but like, find out. And so in that way, I actually really do practice this a lot. I really believe in asking for what I want. And you see my budget request every year. I just believe.
That's right. You cannot have the moon this year.
And I want the moon. Yeah. I deserve the moon, please. Yeah. And then, so you ask, and then you allow people to respond. And what I've learned in my own experience is that, like, so often, even when people can't give you what they want, I mean, again, thinking about my budget request, right? How often you come back to me and you say, hey, I can't do this, but I can do this, right? We can help with this. What if we, you know, work it like that? And so, in some ways, I feel like it's kind of a legitimate form of like, real exposure therapy. And I wonder what our relationship with rejection should be, right? Like, so many things that make us uncomfortable are in place, I think, naturally to keep us safe, right? Like, you know, what's the picture of, like, the anything with a bunch of, like, holes in it? And you know how people get really uncomfortable with that?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
I forget what it's called, but I was reading something, and I don't remember what I was reading or even how legitimate it was, so Google this yourself. But whatever I was reading was saying that a part of the reason that people feel so uncomfortable when they see a picture of something with a bunch of holes in it is because our genetics are telling us that that thing is poisonous. And so that even though, like, we don't eat those things, it reminds us of different types of plants that our forefathers and foremothers knew would make them sick and die, right? And so what do you think our relationship with rejection should be? Like, do we need to, like, be uncomfortable with rejection, or do we need to, like, get comfortable with rejection?
I think there's a real problem with being so comfortable with rejection that it doesn't give us pause at all. I think so much in scripture talks to us about the need to love one another, to consider others as more important than ourselves, to have a high level of concern for others. And when we are kind of wantonly asking for things for our own benefit and placing others in a position where now they have to reject us, like, that is, I'm sort of imposing on somebody when I do that. So on some level, while we ought not be so afraid of rejection that we don't try anything, if I'm just going, okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and put it in their court every time to make outlandish requests or just kind of ask for whatever I want, and now I'm placing someone else in that awkward position of having to tell me no, like, that's not great either. But so I do think that, and I'm, you know, I'll preach to myself here, to develop that level of confidence and go, okay, if your motives are good, and if you're trying to help, and if what you're asking for, you feel like there is some benefit to it beyond just whatever, my own ego, my own feelings, my own agenda, like, yeah, make the ask, do the thing, try, like, at least attempt. Don't just, you know, be somebody who's sitting back full of regret, but then also to go, okay, I don't want to be somebody who is so, like, rejection means nothing to me, so it doesn't prevent me from doing things that would cause an irritant to others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I do hear you, and I think that there's also something that about when you get rejected that should open up this opportunity for self-assessment.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, if every time you ask a girl out on a date, she says no, and, like, also maybe, like, you don't wear deodorant, right? This is a great time for you to, like, self-assess and say, okay, what parts of this can I take some ownership of and some responsibility of, and just to ask some questions. And I think the key here is to just be really, really grounded in your, like, fundamental identity, you know, as somebody who is, you know, made and loved and redeemed, so that even when you get rejected, you still kind of land back on, you know, kind of this foundation of, this is who I am, this is my inherent value, and I'm not sent spiraling.
Totally.
Outside of that. So here's what I want to do.
Okay, oh boy. All right.
I think this week, three times this week, we should practice this.
Okay.
We should, like, you and I should both go ask three people for something, to do something, whatever. You can choose what it is. And let's come back next week.
Oh, I'm getting nervous just thinking about this.
You look like
you're
getting
nervous. Maybe this shows why I need to do it. I don't know.
I'm enjoying this. But I think you have some options here. I'm like, I'm purposefully not putting, like, a bunch of parameters around this. But I think it'd be interesting to just be able to come back and talk about what our experience was.
How did it feel?
When we
I'm meeting with Pastor Lance right after this. Maybe, I don't know. I could ask
him for his car.
Something right after. There we go.
Ask him for his comic collection.
Ooh, there we go. Hey, could I just have a few of your comic books?
You know, like, he probably would, though. Like, actually legit.
He's such a generous person.
I was going to say, Pastor Lance would be like, definitely, oh, bud.
Yeah. And, you know, an evangelist for the joy of comic books. He would 100%. Probably delight in that. But anyway, all right. Well, we'll see. And hey, feel free to join us in that. Maybe
have a
practice
good time.
A little rejection.
And email us in if you do it. I want to know what happens.
That's right. All right. We'll be right back.
So we read an article from Self Magazine entitled "What's the Difference Between Stress and Burnout?" Basically saying that stress, it comes from measurable specific triggers, whereas burnout is this, like, long prolonged exposure to these demands that lead you to being just emotionally exhausted, really taking a toll on your physical and your mental and your emotional health. And, you know, Pastor Brian, we talk a lot about how, like, there are these words that we don't really know what they mean, but we kind of just use them. And I feel like stress and burnout are two of these words. And so in this article, there are kind of six things that we can look at to determine whether what we're experiencing is burnout and stress. And then, like, how do we work through them, right? Yeah. Because stress is one thing, but burnout is, like, deadly, right? Yeah. Like, so what did you kind of take from this article? What kind of leapt out to you?
Well, there are a few things, and you're absolutely right that, just like we were commenting about therapy in the last segment, like, we can use these words and they get overused to the point of not being all that useful. I was reading the book I was reading this morning, actually. I had another example, which I won't get into. But number one, burnout is specific to work.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is really important. Yeah. That you can get worn out by a lot of things, ranging from maybe you're physically tired, maybe you're, you know, emotionally tired because of challenges in relationships. But burnout is specifically work-related. And the article specifically says things like, terms like, quote, dating burnout and exercise burnout aren't really accurate. That you can be worn out, but that burnout specifically has to do with your vocation. And I choose that word carefully because your vocation could be that you are a student. It could be that you are a stay-at-home parent. It could be that you are a full-time volunteer. Yeah. We're not necessarily talking paid work, but it is specific to the work of your life, whatever that might be. Now, the second thing they point out, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, is it says that burnout won't disappear after you finish a big assignment or hit one deadline. What do you make of that?
I mean, I've experienced it. I've experienced being burnt out and feeling like if I just get this big project done, then I'll feel better, and you don't. And one of the things that really leapt out to me from reading this was this idea that it says stress... unlike stress, burnout usually brings feelings of detachment or cynicism about your career. And the thought that came to me was that when you feel like you are called to your vocation, and some of us, our vocation is our life calling, and some of us, our vocation is not necessarily our life calling. Our vocation allows for us to do our life calling. In my case, and in your case, Pastor Brian, we believe that our vocation is our life's calling. And so the idea that burnout could be a direct threat to what God wants me to do, to how God wants to use me, and to the plans, the ways that he wants me to be impactful in his kingdom building project, yeah, is like, makes me take this idea of burnout really, really seriously,
yeah,
because I don't want to get in the way of what God is doing.
And for all of us, I think to be able to recognize that difference between stress and burnout, and when you do fall into that kind of trap of going, okay, if I can just finish this project, like, then I'll be okay. If that's the case, then that means you're stressed about the project. And then once it's done, sure, it might take a little bit of time to kind of come down from the adrenaline rush, but you can, you know, kind of get back to normal and everything's fine. Burnout does not come because there's just this one thing I got to finish.
Correct.
That's much more persistent. And man, it's so tough. I mean, I think about books like The Body Keeps the Score, which is more about trauma than stress. But I think our bodies carry so much
100%
long-term kind of stuff with us. And it can be really difficult to identify in a real way. Like, man, am I starting to feel burnt out? Not just stressed because, oh, my job's busy during the holidays or my job's busy during tax season. But man, there's just this like long-term residual like back burner stress that is starting to having a major effect.
And one of the things that the article said was that, and this is obvious, but it impacts your work performance significantly, right? Mm-hmm. And so you think about the spiral effects, and even, you know, we're working on a project where we're kind of chronicling the history of our church right now.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're looking at and noticing is that every place where we had, almost every place where we had an employee who ended up needing to not work here anymore because of poor choices or moral failings, you can always look back and see this evidence of burnout, right? That there was too much going on. And I the article doesn't say this, but I imagine that if it impacts your performance at work, it'll probably impact your performance in other places.
Yeah.
So your performance as a parent, your performance as a friend, your performance as a family member, just even your ability to just take good care of yourself, which is your responsibility,
yeah,
right? You are a steward of this life and this body that the Lord has loaned you.
Totally.
That breath in your lungs is loaned, mm-hmm, by God. And so you have this responsibility to take good care of yourself. Here's what I want to know. One, have you personally experienced burnout? And if so, how did you come out of it? And then if you haven't, what are the things kind of in place in your life that you feel like are just instrumental in you not running into burnout?
Yeah, I have had times that I think as I reflect back on them, I would call them, you know, borderline, if not significant, you know, burnout. And it can be really difficult to assess in the moment, especially because I am a pretty active person in terms of like, I work and I have active hobbies. And when I'm not working, I'm doing something at home, or I'm, you know, managing, helping to, you know, along with my wife, of course, managing our household or coaching teams or whatever. Like, I'm not great at like what most people would call rest, because I don't want to. I find it boring. and I think there are times where I go, man, I'm realizing I'm having trouble kind of mustering up the energy to care. And that's what's really scary to me.
That's a good way to look at it.
Is when you just go, I cannot emotionally,
yeah,
get myself to a place where I can give my best effort at XYZ task. And that is, again, that is really scary to go, because I think for me, that is just so against my nature to go like, okay, I want to bring the best that I have. And when I find myself not caring, that's when I realize I need to pay attention to really what's going on inside of me. And what's interesting is I went to an event at Jessup a couple of weeks ago where a pastor named Glenn Packian was speaking, and he was talking about how sometimes and I'm going to get his words a little bit wrong because I don't have my notes from the talk in front of me, but he was basically talking about this idea that kind of the symptoms of burnout and the symptoms of like significant stress can show up later. That it's not like, oh my, like for example, I'll give you an example. When we first started a program here, called The Path. I blanked on the name of it for a second. This was probably 7 or 8 years ago. I was writing the curriculum as we were running the class. And oftentimes that meant I was up like late at night working on the curriculum. I mean, till, you know, midnight, one in the morning, a couple of nights a week. And like, we finished the class went fine. And then we were able to use that curriculum for a couple of years. Like, it was well worth the effort. But even to this day, my ability to like grind late into the night in terms of just, hey, there's work to be done and I can stay up late and do it. Like, I have a hard time doing that anymore. Yeah. And you realize, man, there was maybe something in that moment that just sort of triggered something. But to your second question, and I want to hear your answers as well. I think that you recognize if you're not taking care of yourself, your ability to be your best for the people in your life is going to diminish. So that's where I go, okay, yes, there might be intense seasons, but I'm pretty serious, unless it's just a really crazy week, which does happen, pretty serious about a day off, pretty serious about life-giving hobbies, pretty serious about, yeah, I know the day is going to be crazy, but if I don't get in and, you know, get my work in the gym in the morning, it's going to affect the rest of my day more than just physically, to recognize building these, you know, building in time for good conversation, connection with my wife, connection with friends, like these are all things that are necessary, because if you end up in this pattern of just stress, take a break. Stress, take a break. Like, that builds and it eventually doesn't work. How about you? What have you experienced and how do you prevent it in your life?
I actually just recently came out of a season of burnout in the summer. I got really burnt out. The summer is when we have all of our biggest events. And I mean, I think there are a lot of things that are really important to avoiding burnout and then coming out of burnout. Some of them are obvious. You know, we want our boundaries in place, especially workplace boundaries. Yeah. Listen, that job will not die. I promise you, it will be okay. I think seeking support is really important, right? Getting some help, talking to some folks to assess, because sometimes it's really hard to assess, especially if you are working in a space where the culture, and fortunately, we don't really have this culture as much at Bridgeway, but when there's a kind of a workaholic culture, when there's a very competitive culture, I think that that's why we don't have this so much at Bridgeway, is because we're not really competing with our coworkers for like promotions. Like, I am the young adults pastor. There's nobody really that I'm competing with other than, you know, just trying to do the best job that I have. But I will tell you what really, really helped me to come out of burnout over the summer. It was really kind of a click for me. I was preparing a sermon that I was doing, I think, in July or August for our main service. And there was just this moment. I was up like super late. I was literally like running a summer camp for our young adults. And I was like in the truck at like 2 a.m.
Yeah, that was a tough week.
Hiding from a bear that was outside and like trying to finish my sermon. And basically through the sermon prep, the Lord really put this light on the fact that I had not been relying on him. Mm. And I know that in some ways that sounds very kind of Christian cliche and kind of not like grounded in anything. We're like, what does it mean to rely on God? But for me, it was this headspace of, I'm not asking him for direction, for instruction, and for help on these things that feel little, right? That I'm not saying, Lord, what do you want to do? And I'm not seeing this ministry as belonging to him. I'm seeing it as belonging to me. Mm. And literally, the moment that I was like, oh, wait, this is not mine. I don't own this. This is God. God is our pastor. Yeah. I am an under shepherd, and I can really depend on him to make it work, to make it happen, to bring success. And if it's not successful, I still like can depend on him. That was a game changer for me. And in a way that feels very obvious and shouldn't be hard to talk about, but it just was such the space that I wasn't in.
And it's functionally, whether you're a pastor or not, functionally, it's easy to get outside that place of reliance. And I think that, you know, my turn to kind of get a little cliche about it, but it's cliches exist for a reason. And this one's true, is that when we are taking on ourselves what is meant for God, like, I don't know if you know this, you and I, we're not God.
Surprise.
Right. Yeah. And we're not able to do that. And that can apply whether you're a pastor, you're an accountant, you're a plumber, you're a stay-at-home parent. If we're not recognizing, okay, there is God's work in this and there is my work, And that sense of identity, right? Of like, I'm getting my identity out of my performance. That to me feels like a recipe for burnout.
I think that there's something also really important about coming to purpose in our work. Because if I feel like if the goal is just to make money and to be successful, it is hard to feel like you can reset. Because I know that I am called to be a pastor, there's a lot more safety in saying, wait, let me take a step back because I'm not going to lose the calling. Does that make sense?
No,
like, I'm not going to, you know, not be able to do this work, whether I get paid for it or not. This is the work that I do. It's the work that I will always do. Even when I'm retired, I will still do discipleship in whatever way that I do discipleship. So I think you got to rediscover kind of your purpose and your work. Why are you doing this work? And then I think you got to take gradual steps. I don't think that it is the same way that burnout is prolonged. I think coming out of that might be a prolonged journey. And so there really is something to self-care, as kind of trendy and cliche as it is to talk about kind of in the world, that there really is something to it. And that to see that, the self-care, as a part of your responsibility in your job. Like, I got to send the emails, I got to do the paperwork, and I got to take a nap.
Well, and I need to have sustainable rhythms. That it's very easy, and I think especially when, if you tend to be a little more workaholic by nature, it is easy to sort of overlook an unsustainable pace. And there is a place, and I'm really grateful that here at Bridgeway, like, it's safe to have these types of conversations. There is a place to go, okay, maybe you need to talk with your supervisor to go, this feels unsustainable.
Yeah.
How can we fix it? Or I mean, I've had times with people that report to me where I've gone, okay, I can tell you're not in a good place. And we've literally whiteboarded, here is everything that you're doing. What do we need to pull off of this list so that we can get you healthy? And there's a place for that. And that's, I think, the difference between, oh, it's been a stressful season, I just need a break, versus, okay, this doesn't really feel sustainable. So I would encourage our listeners, like, as, if you're feeling that in your own life, to look at your work life and to determine, is there safety to go to a supervisor or somebody and go, okay, how do we make this sustainable? Because I think most healthy supervisors want their employees to thrive, hopefully for their personal care for them, but also benefit to the organization.
I think one thing that is important to just add really quickly, and this is the last thing I'll say on this, the article talked about how if you're experiencing burnout, that some of the normal self-care, like, oh, I'm just going to take a couple of days off, or, you know, I'm going to take a good nap, that those things might not cure kind of the burnout immediately, that your normal kind of stress relievers that usually kind of help alleviate stress won't magically fix your symptoms. And so basically, you're going to have to be more intentional about coming out of that burnout. I think what I took from the article is that you cannot accidentally come out of burnout.
Yeah.
That you can't just hope eventually you're going to feel better and you will, that something has to change. And if you're not intentional about it, often what that something is and what we've experienced, what we experience as a church is that the something that happens that changes everything is something really negative, right?
Yeah.
The pastor has an affair, the whatever it is, there's a big blow up at work, something like that. And so we want to make sure that that's not the direction that we go in.
Yeah.
And so this, I'm going to take this moment and just kind of plug in our mental health care ministry here at Bridgeway, soulcare.church.
Yep.
Soulcare is professional mental health counseling by professionals in that field. And I would tell you that if you are experiencing burnout and you are here at Bridgeway, or part of Bridgeway, or even not, because I think we offer telehealth, reach out to Soulcare just to get some support in figuring out what does this look like for me to navigate my burnout.
Yep. Amen. Good stuff. We'll be right back. So, Pastor Judah, it is the week of All Hallows Eve, Halloween, if you will. Also Reformation Day, side note.
Oh,
but
there's that.
There's that. But since Halloween is coming up here on Thursday, I have a question for you, and that is, can Christians celebrate Christmas?
It, you know, it's such a complicated question for Christians.
Did you hear my question?
Yes. Can Christians celebrate Halloween?
That is not what I said.
What did you say?
I said, can Christians celebrate Christmas?
Oh, Christmas! Yikes!
I should add, as in this case, this is not already obvious, I did not warn Pastor Judah.
You
I
was sure ask him this did question. Not. Because no, you can't celebrate Christmas. How dare you?
Okay, so you're joking with me, but so Jesus was not born on December 25th. He was likely born in the spring.
He was.
You know that. The timing of the Christmas celebration was moved to December 25th because that was the time of year for the pagan celebration of Saturnalia. Things like Christmas trees have pagan origins. For example, Romans would have evergreen trees in their home, both to symbolize the coming of spring, and then they would put metal ornaments to worship their various pagan deities. Not to mention the fact that so much of Christmas today is wildly secular and in many regards promotes things like consumerism and greed, things that our faith explicitly teaches us that we ought to avoid. So in light of both the pagan origins of the celebration and some of the challenges of this time of that time of year in terms of how it might promote behavior that is unhealthy, my question to you is, can Christians celebrate Christmas?
Yeah, I mean, I think you stay
with me if you're ready to brand me a heretic. This is going to have a point.
Well, because you're making this great point about this challenge that I think the church has always had, right? Which is that Christianity is actually a fairly young religious system, right? And every time that a group of people, whether it's folks in Galatia or folks in Corinth or folks in Ethiopia, every time that that group of people received the message of the gospel, then there was this kind of wrestling to try to figure out, okay, what does it look like for us to practice Christianity as a people that already has a developed culture and framework and way of seeing things? So, yes, there are all of these like Roman and Norse traditions that very much inform how we celebrate Christmas. It's the same with Easter, right? There are like fertility festivals and other kind of pagan traditions. I mean, there's a reason that we do Easter egg hunts.
Yeah.
That does not come out of the Bible, right? Jesus did not hatch out of an egg.
Yeah.
So there's this complexity with these holidays, but there's something really specific. We give the pass for Christmas and Easter, but not Halloween.
That's true. And
some folks, anyway.
My answer, by the way, for those who are still ready to brand me a heretic or something, to can Christians celebrate Christmas, is of course we should celebrate Christmas. It is a celebration of the birth of Christ, whether or not it happened exactly at that time or not. And the reason I bring that up in a discussion about Halloween is because it all depends on the meaning that we are placing into the tradition.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
Ought Christians give and receive gifts? I think that is a wonderful thing. And also to recognize that as we give and receive gifts, they are markers that point us back to the ultimate gift of Christmas, Jesus Christ. Go ahead, bring in that tree and decorate it and enjoy it. It's not an act of pagan worship. Like, it's very clearly not. Like, nobody is bringing a tree into their house going, and here's our ornament for, you know, Jupiter, and here's our ornament for, you know, these different deities. It is a celebration of the season. And it is, in celebrating Jesus in December, we are not, like, giving a nod to the winter solstice or anything else. This is just when we are celebrating Jesus.
That's right.
Now, if a Christian is sitting here going, yeah, I want to celebrate Jesus on December 24th and on December 22nd, the winter solstice, I want to honor my pagan gods. I'd be like, no.
A little complicated
that's
come talk.
That's
come step into my office.
So Halloween. Yeah. So that is my sort of odd way of getting through this discussion of Halloween, that Halloween has some very dark origins. And you're probably more prepared to speak to that than I am, but that is a real thing, that there is a level of kind of spiritual darkness that is associated in kind of years past with Halloween.
Yeah, so let's just run through really quickly this history. There was this Celtic festival that kind of marked the end of one season and the beginning of winter. And kind of during that season, on that day, the Celts believed that the boundary between the living and the dead became blurred. And so people would wear these costumes to kind of ward off the ghost and the evil spirits. And when Christianity spread to that part of the world, essentially they merged that Celtic festival with All Saints Day, which is supposed to be on November 1st, making October 31st All Hallows Eve. Mm-hmm. And over time, kind of that developed into the holiday that we now know as Halloween. Now, the interesting thing about this holiday is that there's also this kind of conversation about the supernatural that makes it complicated. And yeah. So, like, my partner, for example, she is from a country where there is a lot of, like, actual witchcraft practice, a lot of really dark practices, not necessarily associated with the day of Halloween, but just kind of as a piece of the cultural fabric where she's from.
Yeah.
And so for her, the idea of celebrating a day where people dress as witches and that sort of thing is just a real big trigger for her.
Would it be accurate to say it is, based on her cultural background, it is pretty impossible for her to separate that from the kind of spiritual element that it symbolizes?
Correct. Especially because she has seen and experienced in real life the ways that that practicing actual witchcraft, that tap dancing with the demonic is dangerous and has real consequences. And so for a lot of people who are Christians, one, we don't know the history, right? I think that that's important, right? To understand where it comes from. And then two, it really depends on what your relationship is with, again, we talked about in an earlier segment, the ways that words are attached to experiences and ideas that may be different for all of us. You know, when I hear the word wizard, I think of Harry Potter and Gandalf.
Right.
Right?
That is fake.
That is fake.
It's entertaining.
And that's also just not like super dark. I mean, Tolkien was a Christian, and there's like a ton of Christian theology in The Lord of the Rings. So when I think of Gandalf, I don't think of something dark and scary. But there are folks that do. And so I'm curious, what do you think, how do you think that we as Christians should be navigating, thinking about this particular holiday and then how we participate in it?
Right. So first of all, I think there needs to be an understanding that for most of us, not all, but most of us in America, we simply do not have that type of background that you were referring to, where there is this like legitimate spiritual darkness. And we need to have a tremendous amount of understanding and compassion on those who that is their background and who are unable to separate kind of the fun and silliness of Halloween from what they've experienced. I went to seminary with a guy who came from a culture that it was that way. And he was like, absolutely not on Halloween. And to his credit, like, he wasn't a jerk about it. He wasn't like criticizing the rest of us that are like dressing up in silly costumes.
Yeah, don't do that.
But for him, he was just like, nope, can't do it, which 100% respect that. And this is where it gets, but I think for others of us, this is where it gets back to the whole question of like, can Christians celebrate Christmas? Which is of course a tongue-in-cheek question meant to help make my point.
Correct.
That if to the extent that October 31st, this holiday we call Halloween, is about dressing up in costumes, having fun, getting candy, being out in your community, which, like, how often in this day and age do people just randomly show up at your house? So it's an opportunity to meet your neighbors. As long as it does not kind of sear your conscience or get you to a point where, like, I don't feel right about this, I don't see a problem with it at all. I don't see it as something that is promoting Christianity. I don't see it as something that is opposing Christianity.
Correct.
It is sort
cultural.
Of neutral, right? And I think there are huge opportunities in Halloween. In years gone by, like, we've set out a table and like had hot chocolate for, you know, grownups as they go by and just tried to kind of, hey, be a blessing to our neighborhood. But I do think some caution is appropriate in things like, to what extent are we promoting ourselves to things that are excessively scary or glorifying, you know, something grotesque or excessive violence and things like that. But I am comfortable going, there is nothing overtly extra spiritual. I say extra spiritual because everything in life is spiritual.
Sure.
There's nothing overtly extra spiritual about my kids dressing in costumes and going trick-or-treating.
Yeah, that's always my debate with folks who are like super, super anti-Halloween is I try to get to what piece of it are you uncomfortable with, right?
Yeah.
Because are you comfortable going to a costume party? Mm-hmm. You know, on a different day?
Yeah, what about July?
You know, are you like, which pieces of it are uncomfortable? And then how much of it is grounded in facts versus feelings, right? And that doesn't mean that you need to celebrate it if you feel uncomfortable.
Sure.
But what it does mean is I think that there does need to be some caution in how we talk about Christians who do, because I've seen people become really, really judgmental and mean about it. I mean, even we just had our Harvest Festival. I remember last year at our Harvest Festival, we had people show up to the church and protest.
Oh, it happened last night, too.
Oh, were they here last night?
Oh, yeah.
Did y'all take them food?
I don't remember. I wasn't really.
I hope y'all took them some of them burnt hot dogs we was giving out. So I think that there's something to think about in terms of how we judge other people's decisions, even while we're making our own decisions. Growing up as a kid, my mom's rule was we could dress up, but we could not be anything evil. And so, like, so I actually used to hate it because we would just have the cheeses. My mom was like, this year, let's be M&M's. What? Not the rapper, like the candy. No, Mom, I want to be like, I don't know, Scream.
Yeah.
And so I think different folks have different relationships with the ideas of things, and we just have to hold space for it. And it points to this bigger conversation that Christianity is a large tent.
Yeah.
It is a large umbrella. It is a global thing, and each culture and each people group and each family are always in this conversation about what is it. I will tell you this. I'm okay with Halloween. I am more concerned, honestly, about our relationship to, like, the 4th of July and, like, patriotism and how we can, like, become worshipful for that more than Halloween. But that's me, right? And so that doesn't mean that you shouldn't enjoy your 4th of July customs. And it doesn't mean that we can't do a harvest festival and hand out candy. Although, if you come to my house on October 31st, I'm giving away ketchup packages and mustard packages and everything in that drawer.
So you're getting egged later that night.
Goodness. You know, that probably could happen, huh?
Yeah, you might want to go get some candy.
Yeah,
well, I think to put what you said in different words, just that idea of, like, we need to hold space for different people, have different experiences.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Just because Halloween bothers somebody doesn't mean there's some, like, killjoy that wants to interfere with everyone's fun. And at the same time, I think your question of, like, what aspect bothers you is helpful, because I think in most cases, somebody who's really bothered by Halloween, if they shared that with me, I'd go, like, yeah, that element of it bothers me too. But because I have no personal experience with it, it doesn't even cross my mind as I'm celebrating Halloween. It does cross your mind, not you specifically, but, like, this hypothetical person I'm talking to.
Sure.
In which case, great. Like, right. Don't, like, I would never impose on that person, you ought to celebrate, because you cannot detach from the kind of spiritual connotations. You got to hold space.
Well, and remember that there are other spaces that this exists that we would say, well, that's super extreme. I mean, I think about, you know, I had a best friend when I was a kid. He was a Jehovah's Witness. And I remember it was his birthday, and I gave him my favorite toy. He would come over, we'd play toys, and he loved this particular toy. And I wanted to give it to him for his birthday.
Cannot do that.
His mother brought him, marched him back to my house and gave it back. And that feels extreme to me, right? Mm-hmm. But I have to hold space for his experience, their understanding, and just try to be nice and patient.
Yep. So. For us, you know what we're going to do on Thursday? We're going to do every Halloween. We'll cook some pizza. Parents will come over, sit in the driveway. They'll pass out candy while we go around trick-or-treating.
Let me tell you what Judah's going to do.
And we're going to hang out. And you know what?
Judah is going to go to sleep. I'm going to take a nap.
The lights will be out.
Listen, you can ring that doorbell if you want to. It's going to be disconnected. You're not going to disturb my sleep.
We'll be right back. For our game, we are going to play one of my favorite games we do on this show, and that is Blessed or Stressed, where both Pastor Judah and I have found an item from the recent news that we are going to share about, and then the other person who will be hearing about this bit of news for the first time will share if they are blessed or stressed by this information, this cultural phenomenon, whatever the case
may
be.
Last time we played this, you ruined socks for me. So let's see what we're going to ruin today.
All right, so recently, Pastor Judah, an airport in New Zealand has changed a policy, or I should say has instituted a policy, and with that policy has hung signs in the drop-off area, and I will show you the sign. It says, max hug time, 3 minutes. For fonder farewells, please use the car park. There it is. I'm showing it to you. We will link to this in the show notes.
I cannot believe this.
So you are now only allowed to say goodbye to your boo, to your mother, to your father, to your loved one, whoever, for up to 3 minutes. This has sparked strong reaction with commenters on Facebook outraged at the curfew on cuddles, as it is says, while others were marveling at the fact that there's even a free drop-off area at all, given that we seem to be charged fees for everything. But the airport's staff has said things that they have just seen lengthy visits take place, often with significant PDA happening at their airport drop-off areas, and thus they have the need to say, you must finish your drop-off in 3 minutes or less, and if you cannot do that, you're going to need to go somewhere else.
So, I have questions.
Okay, what are your questions?
So first of all, is this, when we talk about the area, is this like where you pull up to the curb to drop somebody off at the airport? Is that where they're saying?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. I'm a little more peaceful about this because I feel like low-key we already have that here in the United States. You know, when you pull up to the airport, you know, there's always the dude in the vest or the woman in
telling
the vest.
To move along.
Yeah, move along. So I'm with that. But here's what I want to know. Who's hugging for 3 minutes?
3 minutes is a long
hug. That's a long hug. Like, yeah. I know, listen, I got family who live in different countries, whatever. Maybe you don't see them. I have grandparents who live in Kenya. We've, like, seen them once in, like, 10 years. I'm not hugging anybody for 3 minutes. I mean, think about how long. We should just stop talking for 3 minutes. And just
it's
to
a long time.
So I think in some ways, I'm kind of blessed by this. Because wrap it up. What are you doing? So I need to park and drop off my person too. Move. So you knew you were coming to the airport yesterday. Y'all should have hugged at the house.
Here's what's funny. Airport CEO. This just feels a little tone deaf to me, but it's very funny. The CEO of the airport, in defending the policy, he describes airports as, quote, hotbeds of emotions. And then he pointed to a study suggesting that a 20-second hug is enough to get the burst of the love hormone oxytocin.
Move.
And then the customer should move along. Which, okay, like, you and I can sit here and go, yeah, okay, that's true, move it along. Yeah, you go ahead and be the one who's saying goodbye to your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife,
who's
whatever.
Who's getting ready to go off to Afghanistan.
Like, yeah, gone for 3 months.
And you're pregnant.
20 minutes, you got your oxytocin, let's move it along. I don't think we can be, or sorry, 20 seconds. Yeah, 20 minutes, that's a little much. But I don't think we can be quite so clinical about this.
No, but. I think you're right. I think, but I do think that, like, also, you did know.
Yes.
That you were going to, like, you bought this ticket a long time ago. So I think that there is some onus to, like, the rest of us actually need to, like, park, drop off our purse, and get out of the way. Because here's the thing about airports. At those things, you have to catch planes. And they do this thing called closing the door.
Yes, they do.
And they say, this is your final boarding call. The door will close in 5 minutes, and it will not reopen.
Yeah.
So you can't, I think that if there's, and I don't know if this is what was happening in New Zealand, but if this was, like, causing people to, like, be late for their flights, then, like, yeah, you got to go 3 minutes and then be on your way.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of this is specific to New Zealand, though, because I think about, you know, I love to travel and I've wanted to go to New Zealand for like 10 years and I never go because that flight is so long.
Yep.
And when you only have, like, often I only go away for like a week or several days, maybe 2 weeks at the most, I often just can't, you know, do 3 days out of my 6-day trip being on the flight to New Zealand.
Yep.
So I can imagine that there in particular, that the people who are flying internationally probably are going far and they're not going to see each other in a
long
time.
Lots of flights where you're leaving for a while.
So
I wish I had watched this before bringing this up, but I clicked on a link from the article and there is actually a 5-minute video from the CEO explaining this new policy, which I'm eager to watch. So you're saying you are blessed by...
I'm kind of blessed by it. Listen, hug, kiss, and get on the plane.
Yeah.
You knew last week that on Friday he was going to the airport. So on Thursday afternoon, y'all should have laid up and cuddled up and hugged and kissed and ate dinner and whatever else you needed to do. The airport, this is not a conjugal visit. Move. Move.
You know, Pastor Judah, if this whole pastoring thing doesn't work out for you, I think you might have a career writing romance novels. I mean, just writes itself.
Listen, I love you. Move. What are we doing?
Okay. I am blessed by this as well. This could just become chaos if we've got people, you know, spending who knows how much time.
3 minutes. Think about how long 3 minutes is.
Before they go. So,
first of all, when have you ever, think about this.
Yeah.
In the last year of your life,
yeah.
Can you think about a hug that's lasted more than a minute that you enjoyed? Maybe with your wife.
Yeah, I mean certainly not with anybody other than my wife. But yeah, I mean, yeah, probably not. I mean, maybe the handful of times where it's more, and even then it's more like, oh, we're in the kitchen cooking or
correct.
Whatever, and there's
and
nothing
I just
to do,
my wife.
So we might hold for a little
correct.
While.
Correct, we're laying in the bed and we're cuddling, something like that. Nobody's just standing up and hugging for 3 minutes. Move.
All right.
I'm also not a hugger, so don't listen to me.
Okay, so if you want to practice rejection therapy, ask Pastor Judah for a hug.
And I will give you one because I actually worked through this with my therapist. My therapist said that I have learned how to become a hugger because of my profession.
Oh, well.
I give great hugs.
Good on you.
And they're going to be 30 seconds.
What's yours?
All right, so this is not a brand new trend, but I am new to it. And it's this trend of becoming zero waste, living a zero waste lifestyle. And so the idea is that you reduce the amount of waste you produce by making these lifestyle decisions like using everything reusable, not using like plastic, Ziplocs, foil, not buying anything that comes in a package. So you bring all of your own, you know, boxes and Tupperware and whatever to the grocery store to buy things in bulk. Everything, there's a spectrum of how extreme it goes. Some folks do it as extreme as I take one shower a week. I reuse that water to flush the toilet. I don't use toilet paper. I use other creative ways of keeping myself clean. I don't buy new clothes. I don't buy new food. I was watching a video of a lady who lives in New York, and she goes to where the grocery stores throw their trash away, kind of that back alleyway. And in there, she forages for stuff that's, you know, just recently expired, that sort of thing. They, you know, again, shop package free. They compost. This is a little gross. Human waste. They repurpose everything.
I think we define a little gross differently. Go on.
That's fair. And so this idea of using zero waste. And the goal is to not produce more waste than can fit in a mason jar for a year. And so I wonder, does this sound blessed or are you stressed about
gracious. This?
This feels like it could be up your alley.
Try not to be insulted by that.
See you being like...
So, this is complicated. On the one hand, there is benefit to us being a bit more mindful about the amount of waste in our lives and what we're doing. I mean, I think about just even things like clothing, like how many of us have far more clothing than we need. And frankly, we have more than we need and we get rid of it sooner than
we
need to.
I need all 102 pairs of my shoes. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for making my point. And I think that it's easy to overlook the way that like simple decisions like that really impact our environment and everything else. So generally speaking, I'm very pro some level of kind of ecological consciousness. And I think even as from a Christian perspective of going, I want to care for the world God has made, and thus I want to, you know, make relatively responsible choices. And I'm not generally one to criticize someone else's lifestyle as long as they're not causing harm to others. So the idea of going, okay, I want to go completely zero waste. No, I'm not into that. That to me feels like a bridge too far. Now, if somebody feels compelled to do that, as long as they're not hugely imposing on others and they're not being excessively preachy and performative about it, go for it. I support you and what you're doing. So I am blessed by the idea of, sure, let's try to be a little more mindful of our use of the natural resources that God has given us. I am stressed by, it feels like this could become very kind of elitist and a little like,
100%.
You know, you kind of use, it's a really simple word, but the word escapes me, where you're just kind of going like, yeah, hey, this is who I am and this is what I'm doing and you ought to be
and
doing
I'm
the
better.
Same thing. And I'm better than you. So I'm not into that. And I'm definitely not into some of the extreme measures you described. So I'm stressed by that. How about you?
So I was blessed by the idea. I was like, oh, this is great. I really care about the planet. And I'll tell you, I'm deeply, deeply concerned about like the planet that your children are going to inherit and their children are going to inherit. And so I actually tried this. I tried for a week. I was like, I'm going to go zero waste. Like, really, it was like, I was like, going to do it. It's so impractical. It is so impractical. And the community that I was kind of trying to engage with, you know, to kind of come alongside, because they were doing this, you talked about it not being, you know, imposed on other people. But, like, one of the things is, like, often there is a hygiene issue because instead of wearing deodorant, you're like, oh, I'm going to put coconut oil under my arms. And, like, look, different people's bodies do different things. My body needs deodorant. You understand? I need all of the aluminum and all the parabens. I need all the things, right? And so it's just not practical. And there's some parts of it on the most extreme end that are gross. I am not reusing dirty bathwater.
Right.
I just, well, the planet has to die. If that's what it takes. Listen, sometimes
what kind of planet do you want to live on?
And here's the thing. This is a little bit selfish, but I just don't like being inconvenienced. I mean, I think at some point we have to let God be God. And if he dresses the lilies with beauty and splendor, I don't need to use a paper straw. Hand me a real straw. I want to theoretically take good care of the planet, but pray for the pastor.
To a point.
Pray for the pastor, because I just, them soggy straws and digging through trash for food. And then also just, I think about how often I forget and am inconvenienced by forgetting my grocery bags, you know, the reusable grocery bags. I can't be bothered. I cannot be bothered. I'm going to pray for the trees and the planet and all the things. And I try to recycle. And that's about as far as we go.
Fair enough. Well, you can decide if you were blessed or stressed by either of those topics. Hope you were blessed.
I'm like 40% waste.
By the episode. 40%.
55%
that's not bad.
Waste.
That's not bad.
That's what I want to get to. 0% is too much.
It's too much. All right. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it.
Bye.